And you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. Coming up next is In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show, streaming live with listeners from Beirut to London, from Beijing to Bridgeport, only on WPKN.
Singing the song of angry men. It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of a drum, there is a life about to stop and tomorrow comes.
À la volonté du peuple et à la santé du progrès.
Das ist die Symphonie von Menschen, die nicht länger Sklaven sind.
Aratani-Azi, Inochina, Hajimaru, Asuga, Kita, Toki, Sosa, Asuga.
And good afternoon. Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. And if you want to write to us directly, just drop us a note at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we will respond personally to your question or your comment. With me in the studio is In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott-Rowe.
Good afternoon.
And also behind the board today helping us out is Shell Tarrant. Thanks very much for being here today, Shell.
You're very welcome.
I'm happy to report that during 2012, our In Context website was visited by listeners from 96 countries. And Marchand and I are really pleased that In Context, in particular, our unique coverage and analysis of the global wars, has attracted such a far-flung audience. And we're only able to do this because of the generous support of listeners like you. So whether you'd listen to In Context locally on 89.5 FM or listen from a distant location via WPKN's internet stream or our archives, please consider going to WPKN.org and making a tax-deductible pledge to support our nonprofit listener-supported WPKN. While Marchand and I, like the other programmers at WPKN, work without pay, WPKN still needs your help to pay for essential services like our transmitter, electricity, and the salaries of our bare-bones staff of one full-time and two part-time employees. So thanks very much for your generous help. In today's show, we're going to focus on the global wars again. We'll start with a review of important recent developments, and then we'll spend the rest of the program focusing on one very important issue. That issue is whether the current United States military strategy is out of touch, whether it's obsolete in light of today's military realities. So that's what we'll talk about after we do a brief review of recent developments in the global wars. And with regard to that, Marchand, let's start with Asia. In December, North Korea, which has the nuclear bomb, defied international warnings and successfully launched a long-range Anha 3 rocket. Could you talk about the significance of the new North Korean rocket?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I think really has struck me as almost bizarre is that, you know, we go into Iraq, we're going to stop Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons might be working on a nuclear bomb and this and that, and oh, let's get him. And we go in and we kick his behind, and, you know, what heroes we are. We've eliminated a nuclear threat. Wonderful, except for the fact that we've completely ignored a country that not only has, it turns out Saddam didn't have any chemical weapons, now we discover a country that has a nuclear bomb, has rockets that we thought might be capable of delivering a ballistic warhead, but let's face it, they won't be able to do it for another 20 years, and whoops, they're successful. And what makes this so significant is that not only do they have a nuclear bomb, but now they have a rocket that's capable of carrying this atomic weapon all the way to the east coast of the United States. And so it was shocking. It shocked the U.S. intelligence community. I would like to say that while Wolf Blitzer seemed floored, I wasn't floored. And I'll tell you exactly why. Because China and Russia have been supplying North Korea with scientific technology for rockets, for the nuclear bomb. You know, I was listening to K.T. McFarland on Fox News, and she was saying, well, this might be signs that Iran, you know, was giving rocket technology to to North Korea. And I thought how ludicrous that was. I'm like, yeah, sure, so a bunch of third world countries are getting together. Don't be stupid, woman. The fact is that the reason why North Korea got this bomb is we're pushing China in the Far East, and we're pushing Russia in the Middle East. We're trying to edge China militarily and influentially out of the Far East. We're trying to push their influence back into China.
This is all about the so-called pivot to the Pacific that Obama did in the last year, moving the majority of the U.S. Navy towards the Pacific, establishing a new base or expanded base in Australia.
Exactly. And moreover, we're pushing the Chinese in Asia. We're building up our forces in Australia. We're building up our forces in South Korea, building up our force in Japan, moving our ships into the Pacific to try to push the Chinese back. And at the same time, we're trying to push the Chinese and the Russians in Africa. We're trying to push them in the Middle East. So obviously, it's gotten to this point now where the Chinese and the Russians have decided they've had enough. They said, all right, you want to play hardball? We're going to give the North Koreans the technology to successfully launch a rocket. And that's why our intelligence agencies were floored, because North Korea by itself could not have developed this rocket technology that would deliver this thing up into the upper atmosphere.
You know, despite all the billions, I think it's like $100 billion we spend a year on a national security intelligence, they seem to be missing the big picture as they missed the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt.
So, well, you know, I don't know where all of this money goes. But,
well, you know where it goes is that I think a lot of the intelligence does get collected, and they say, okay, well, this is what's going on. Then they go to President Obama or whoever's the president at the time saying, you know, Mr. President, it appears that Russia has these new submarines, and which we'll get into later in the show, and North Korea is about to launch a missile that might hit the east coast or the west coast of the United States. And the president goes, meh. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that I personally believe it goes down to, are they corrupt or are they stupid? There is a cognitive dissonance, I think, that goes on inside the heads of the leadership of this country. And they say, well, yeah, you know, we want to topple Assad, we want to take on Iran. And then some general walks in and goes, sir, we're ignoring the fact that China is giving missile technology to North Korea. And the president goes, la, 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 I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, it
because it's actually
plan,
frightening.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit in with his plan. It upsets his plan. It upsets the plans to topple Assad. It's also very upsetting because people thought we won the Cold War. And we did win the Cold War. But people think that we've won the Cold War. It's over. We're the world superpower. Well, now China and Russia are pushing back. And they're saying, hey, you guys aren't the superpower anymore.
Marshawn, what's the significance of this regarding South Korea and regarding Japan, that is North Korea's new rocket?
Well, what it's doing is the South Koreans are frightened. The South Koreans are very frightened because we won't allow them to defend themselves. You know, South Korea was bombed by North Korea. 36 South Korean sailors were killed when a North Korean submarine sank a South Korean destroyer. Now, if this had happened to the U.S., I mean, if you imagine, this would be tantamount to Venezuela or Cuba sinking an American warship. This was about a year ago.
Yes.
Sinking an American warship. And then North Korea bombs a South Korean island and kills a bunch of South Korean civilians. So the South Koreans are really angry, and they're like, we have to retaliate. And President Obama, once again, goes, no, 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 you cannot retaliate.
How many troops do we have in South Korea?
We have about 50,000, but we're frightened of an actual war on the Korean Peninsula, and we will sacrifice South Koreans, we will sacrifice South Korea's honor and national sovereignty if it means avoiding a war on the Korean Peninsula, because North Korea is armed and equipped by China. Moreover, North Korea is an ally of the Chinese.
So we're really not capable of fighting a land war on the Korean Peninsula.
There was an article in the Army Times that said, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying that the United States is militarily, as it stands right now, incapable of responding to a major conflict anywhere in the world. And the reason is because we're spread very thin. We have an armed forces of a little over a million. We have...
That's active duty?
Active duty. Yes. And then you have the reserve and guard, which makes probably close to 2 million. But they're spread out over 300 bases around the world. There are
over 700.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, according to
700,
Thomas Johnson,
700
yeah.
military bases around the world. They're very stretched out. And what Obama's doing by cutting the troops, the logic that he has, that his administration has, is that we're going to fight these wars through special forces, which is great if you're fighting the Taliban. Stinks if you're fighting a conventional army.
And briefly, how does this connect to resurgent nationalism in Japan?
That's the other thing. The Japanese have seen what's going on in South Korea. Now, the South Koreans have a very tiny army. And the South Koreans are pretty much at our mercy and the North Koreans' mercy. North Korea can go in and murder a South Korean president, and it has happened. and North Korean Special Force went in and murdered South Korean members of government, tried to murder the president of South Korea, and we just told them, no, you can't do anything to retaliate. The Japanese see this going on. Now, the Japanese have a very, very rigid sense of honor. If the North Koreans were to sink a Japanese ship, the Japanese wouldn't ask for American permission. They wouldn't say, oh, well, you know, okay, the Americans don't want us to do it, we're upset, but what are we going to do? The Japanese would have to retaliate. National honor be at stake. I mean, these are people who hold honor to such a high extent that they will die of radiation poisoning before admitting to a mistake.
Is the current Japanese leader a nationalist?
Shinzo Abe, who's the current prime minister, was elected on a platform of eliminating the pacifism clause from Japan's constitution, which we had them install at the end of World War II, saying that we're a pacifist nation, we're never going to go to war. He said he's going to eliminate that. He's also going to rebuild Japan's military. And a lot of this also has to do with the row Japan has been having with China over a series of islands south of Japan. The Japanese call them the Senkoku Islands. The Chinese call them the Doyu Islands. And they've been arguing over who owns rights to them. Because more importantly, it's not just the islands, it's natural gas.
And this is the natural gas, and there have been flyovers by the Chinese and patrol boats going through the Japanese waters of these islands.
It started out with a few fishing ships, and the Japanese beat them back with water cannons and said, get the heck out of here. So then the Chinese Navy shows up. And Chinese Navy ships would make an incursion, Japanese Navy ships would show up, the Chinese would leave. Then they would go back and forth like this. Well, I believe it was the day before yesterday. It was the day before yesterday. The Chinese People's Liberation Army Air Force flew over the islands. Well, the Japanese scrambled their jets and flew their jets to meet the Chinese, and they flew back and forth and circled each other and then flew off.
And again, there's nobody there. It's just about the natural gas.
It's about the natural gas, yeah. And also national prestige.
Yes.
For the Chinese, these are islands they demanded at the end of World War II, and we basically snubbed them and said, no, you don't need them.
So
the Chinese, for them, it's an issue of national prestige. It's also an issue of sticking it to the Americans and the Japanese. If they can take the control of these islands, they basically say to the Americans, than the Japanese, look, your de facto military hegemony in Asia is over. We wanted these. We took them. You couldn't do anything about that.
So we're going to have to watch that situation carefully, because Japan could end up in the front line in a conflict with China. But let's move on now to the Mideast, because we need to have a good chance to discuss the issue of U.S. military technology and its global and our global military strategy. Let's look briefly at Syria. As we've been reporting for about a year and a half now, the Syrian war is essentially a struggle for control of the Mideast oil and natural gas between, on one side, the U.S., NATO, and its allies, including the Mideast monarchies, and on the other side, Russia and its allies, including Iran. At a press conference just this past Friday, Defense Secretary Panetta and the Joint Chief of Staff General Dempsey, although still calling for the overthrow of the Syrian government, ruled out direct U.S. military involvement in Syria. And they also confirmed that U.S. naval, air, and marine forces have been withdrawn from waters near the Syrian coast, where they had been assembled in large quantities. Meanwhile, a large Russian fleet has taken their place. So would you say that this match, or at least the set, has gone to the Russians?
Trying to switch mics. I definitely would say that this set has gone to the Russians, because what's incredible about this is, again, for the first time in U.S. military history, the Russian fleet showed up in the Mediterranean, and 15 warships, untold number of submarines, showed up in the Mediterranean. Our fleet was off the coast with the French and the British. We were ready to hammer Syria. We had our entire Persian Gulf fleet there. We were ready to go. And the Russians showed up with a fleet of warships and basically, under no uncertain terms, told us, we're not going to let you intervene in Syria. And so, again, President Obama wants to topple Assad, but he's terrified of a direct confrontation with either the Russians or the Chinese.
We've been doing it indirectly by having our surrogate Qatar bring in these jihadist fighters from places like Libya, and they've been committing acts of terrorism, as Assad says. Although I'm sure that there are people who don't like his regime in Syria, but largely this is motivated by outside forces brought in by Qatar. And so far, the campaign has been unsuccessful due to Russian military intervention.
Yes, similarly to the fact that we're backing the rebels, the Russians are backing Assad.
Sure.
If left to their own devices, who would rule the country? Who knows? But the fact is that the only reason the rebels are still fighting is because we back the is because we're backing the rebels, and the only reason the government is still fighting is because we're is because the Russians and the Chinese are backing the government. But what I think is crucial, two things that three things actually that developed in the last couple of weeks. One is the Russians have shipped in 15 warships loaded with thousands of Marines, special forces.
These are Russians. Russian Marines, yeah.
Yeah, which, and their Marines are no joke. They're Marine Spetsnaz. These guys accept a certain death rate in their training. They accept a certain death rate. I mean, it's, you know, their training's nuts. These guys are hardcore. They're very well equipped, and they're all combat veterans. These guys have fought in places like Chechnya. So they're being deployed in mass to Syria to help bolster the Assad regime. Secondly, Russians shipped in a week before that. Again, this is all open source, folks. You can look this up.
And we often consult a site, Debka.com, which is an Israeli military intelligence newsletter.
I could go on and on. All
but
sites
that's one listeners can check this information for themselves, Debka.com.
Debka.com, RIA Novosti, Russia Today, Press TV out of Iran. And then the American press is good, but obviously it's going to be slanted towards not reporting things that are scary to the American people and that make Obama look like a fool, or whoever's the president at the time look like a fool. But the fact is and RIA Novosti and Debka and even the American media had to report this. Russia shipped in dozens of Iskander ballistic missiles. These ballistic missiles are hypersonic missiles, and they're capable of carrying nuclear warheads, chemical weapons. They have a very large explosive range. They can travel up to 300 miles, and being hypersonic, we can't stop them with our Patriot air defense
which
systems.
Which we installed in Turkey, or in are Turkey, installing them even as we speak.
In Turkey, Jordan, and Israel. Yep. Now, these Patriot missile systems, according to RIA Novosti and the Russian Ministry of Defense, Iskanders were set up opposite our Patriot missile systems. So the Russians, and obviously these things are manned by Russians. I mean, you'd have to be a fool to think they're manned by Syrians. And the reason why I say that is because it's a very complex weapon system. It's not like a Scud. You can't just hand it to somebody and say, here you go. You have to know what you're doing. So it's clear these are manned by Russians, and our intelligence community has to know this. They're manned by Russians. We can't stop them, and they're placed opposite our Patriot missile batteries, which means if they knock out our batteries, our no-fly zone is done. We could implement no-fly zone. They'll hit our batteries, and then what do we do?
So it's a real face-off here.
Exactly. And then to top it off, the Russians have been shipping in S-300 and their latest and greatest S-400 surface-to-air missile systems into Syria. And the Russian chief of staff, it's not Makarov anymore. I'm trying to remember. It's not Makarov anymore. Shoigu, the minister of defense, the new minister of defense, Shoigu, said that the Assad's missile air defense system was, quote unquote, no joke and not to be messed with. And the reason why they're saying this is a threat. This is a, you know, watch out. You want to implement no fly zone, that's fine. We'll shoot down your planes.
And to put this in the bigger picture, Syria is a strategic ally of Iran, and our ultimate objective of the U.S. foreign policy, NATO foreign policy, is really take over Iran. That's been it since day one, since 2001. And so we've got to take, the theory is you've got to take out Syria before you take on Iran, because you don't want to be fighting a two-front war. So right now, we're going to watch this carefully, of course, the Syrian confrontation. But right now, the set at least seems to have gone to the Russians, and we'll see how it develops. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, streaming at WPKN.org. We're in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when our general manager, Steve, reports to the listeners. And in today's show, we just finished our roundup of the global war news. We want to focus on a particular issue today, and we'd like you to join the conversation. We'll be giving out the phone number in just a few minutes. So the balance of our hour, we're going to focus on this very important question. Is current U.S. military strategy, with its reliance on high-tech equipment, such as the drones you've read so much about, is that strategy obsolete? Is it suited for the realities of today's war? And to get some perspective on this issue, Marsand, why don't we take the listeners for a really brief look at the dramatic changes in military technology and strategy which have taken place over the last century. And let's start with World War I. I think it's a good place because that's really the first global war involving modern industrial nations. Marsand, what weapons made their debut in World War I, and how did they affect military strategy?
Well, I think what's really interesting when you look at the First World War is all new weapons of war made their debut. And this is why I always had to, I had to laugh at President Obama when during the debates, you know, he said, well, we don't need battleships. I mean, during World War I, we had horses and bayonets. Well, yes, but what made World War I so costly was they refused to recognize that while they had horses and bayonets, they had all these new weapons of war, machine guns, mustard gas, and all of that. They still needed the horses and bayonets. What it ultimately boiled down to was the theory behind the machine gun, the airplane, and mustard gas, chemical warfare.
And of course, tanks made their debut, too.
And tanks, yes, made their debut. Now, the theory, especially at the beginning of the war when you had the machine gun introduced and the chemical weapons, was that this was going to be so horrible, nobody would dare advance across no man's land. People still did it, and you still had to. No matter how advanced the technology got, no matter how brutal the technology got, at the end of the day, it ultimately boiled down to the man on the ground.
The German generals originally have the idea that they would sweep through France very quickly, take France in a couple of weeks, the way they did during the Franco-Prussian War in the late 1800s. And then why didn't that plan work? Why didn't they just sweep through France like before and take over France?
Well, part of that had to do with the fact that the Austro-Hungarians collapsed a lot faster than they thought, but also a lot of that had to do, again, with the advent of the machine gun. The machine gun was the great force multiplier, and it forced soldiers to dig in, to bury themselves so that they wouldn't get shot.
So instead of a replay of the Franco-Prussian War, in which France was defeated very quickly by Prussia, the World War I settled down to this horrible slogging match of trench warfare.
And to add to that, that really is the face of modern industrial war, is trench warfare. And one thing I'd like to point out to listeners, again, you know, you look at people in our defense industry, in our, you know, the intelligence community, I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and the military brass, because they see this. It's the civilian leadership that don't. The biggest problem is that what people don't realize is they think, oh, World War I was a thing in the past, World War II is a thing in the past, well, drones, airplane bombs will decide it all. No. Great example of modern country-on-country warfare is the Iran-Iraq War in the 80s, because these were two countries that were equally matched. They both possessed air forces. They both possessed, this isn't like the first Gulf War, large armies, air forces, tanks, and chemical weapons. Everything that fundamentally we have if we were to face off with the Russians, the Chinese, or even the Iranians, equally matched armies. And what was the first thing that happened? It devolved into trench warfare. And the reason was because at the end of the day, you don't take ground with drones. You don't take ground with drones. And at the end of the day, drones are useless against a modern army that has the capability of shooting things down.
Well, speaking of the evolution of modern warfare and things that fly, that brings us to Billy Mitchell. He was the commander of American Air Force. There was no separate U.S. Air Force back in World War I, but he commanded our airplanes in France in World War I. And he saw the planes as the wave of the future. Right. And right after the war, he entered this tremendous campaign to try to get the planes recognized as a separate service. And in particular, he thought the airplanes were going to be more important than the great battleships, that which was where all the big money was. But he said, hey, a plane with a couple thousand pound bomb can sink a battleship.
Well, and that's why a lot of the time I feel like Billy Mitchell shouting into the darkness, you know, or Winston Churchill shouting in the darkness, wake up, England. Because one of the problems is that we look at the drone, and we see the drone the way Billy Mitchell saw the airplane. Well, that's a problem. That's not the weapon of significance. Billy Mitchell was saying the airplane is a weapon of significance because you can launch them from aircraft carriers, you can hammer enemy battleships, that's the wave of the future. We're trying to make the drone to the U.S. military what the airplane was to Billy Mitchell.
Well, what happened to Billy Mitchell?
Well, he was pushed out.
He was court-martialed. In 1925, the poor guy was court-martialed for his troubles, for criticizing the military leadership. And here, the guy had been a general during World War I, our top aviator in the service, and he was court-martialed for criticizing the civilian leadership and the admirals for neglecting to invest in aircraft.
And that's really what I'm getting at, and I know I kind of go about it in probably a bit of a convoluted manner, but what I'm getting at is that in reality, the drone is not the weapon of the future. The submarine is the weapon of the future, the intercontinental ballistic missile, and ultimately the ability to mass transport infantry, paratroopers, and armored units based by submarine, which is what the Chinese and the Russians have been investing in, is the wave of the future.
Well, let's go backward a little bit. Before we get to today and the drone, I want to talk about the advent of the airplane. People eventually came around to, didn't they come around to see the wisdom?
After Pearl Harbor.
Okay, but at Pearl Harbor, I did an interesting interview with William Stinnett, who made a very powerful case that Franklin Roosevelt knew of the oncoming attack, at Pearl Harbor. In his book, William Stinnett, Day of Deceit, he presents the physical evidence, a memorandum from the Office of Naval Intelligence, in which a lieutenant commander named Cullum in the Office of Naval Intelligence laid out the steps that the United States needs to take in order to provoke a war with Japan. And we know from Stinnett's research that these steps, such as cruising the American fleet through Japanese waters, moving the fleet's headquarters from California to Honolulu over the objections of the Pacific Fleet commander, all of the stuff was actually done by Roosevelt immediately after he got this memo. So one of the interesting aspects of the attack that Stinnett brought out was that our most modern equipment, the new aircraft carriers, were sent out to sea just before this attack, which he believes he prevents very strong evidence. Roosevelt knew it was coming when it was coming, and Roosevelt left in Pearl Harbor the ancient battleships, which of course got destroyed. So which showed that at that point, our establishment had realized that the future was air power.
Well, I mean, I think regardless, I mean, I'm a technical guy, so I mean, regardless of, you know,
oh, by the way, you can hear that interview. If you go to the our archives, you can hear that interview with Mr. Stinnett.
Well, regardless, I think at the end of the day, what it all boiled down to was the Japanese still, regardless, had to attack the fleet. They ultimately, what it all boiled down to, was the Japanese Air Force bombing the fleet, because we couldn't make them bomb the fleet. They had to do it themselves. And I think what shocked everyone was the inability of these ships to defend themselves.
Yes,
I don't think anyone could have imagined the devastation that took place. I mean, the fleet was demolished from the air. I don't think anyone could have imagined. And that's ultimately where the main message of Pearl Harbor lies, is that
Air power could do the job,
but we refused to heed the warnings of Billy Mitchell, and we refused to acknowledge the advent of this newer technology, because at the time also, we were still investing in, you know, we and other European powers were still investing in the world's biggest cannons, the world's biggest battleships. I mean, that's why you had the Bismarck, you know, the great German battleship, because modern military thinking was going in that direction. But the trend of those who were truly farsighted saw that it was air power, but politicians didn't see it that way. The politicians were saying, it's still the battleship, and that's again analogous to what we're seeing today.
Well, why didn't of course Midway turned out to be a big battle for the aircraft, right? That's where we really turned the tide.
Exactly, but had we, and that's only because
in the Pacific,
and that's only because we were hanging on by our fingernails at that point. If we lost Midway, the Pacific would have been lost to the Japanese, and it was only because I think we were on such a cliff's edge that I think it was only because we were on such a cliff's edge that we turned our military thinking around. Because one of the problems is that when you present politicians with, you know, well, this isn't the future of warfare, this actually is, and you see it throughout military history, the future of warfare is the machine gun. No, it's not. The future of warfare is the tank. No, it's not. The future of warfare is the airplane. And it's not until you're faced with borderline defeat that the politicians are forced to realize the reality.
That's when you get rid of the peacetime generals and you bring on people like Grant.
And Patton, of course. Exactly.
Why didn't World War II turn into a trench warfare replay?
That's, again, a very good question. It was a very mobile war. World War II was a war of maneuver. But also because I think what played a huge role was the fact that there wasn't really a whole lot to counter the tank at the time. You know, back then, especially when it came to whether it was with us and the Germans, I had the pleasure of talking to a gentleman who was a veteran, and he had served on an anti-tank crew, U.S. Army anti-tank crew during the war. And he said that we had nothing that could stop the German tanks. It took an airplane bomb. So we had absolute air supremacy over Europe, which meant that whenever we ran into these clusters of German tanks, we hammered them from the air, and then we rolled on through. And the Germans had effective anti-tank weapons, but again, they weren't as mass-produced, and really the Germans weren't, it wasn't until the end of the war that the Germans were starting to really mass-produce anti-tank weapons, the Panzerschreck, the Panzerfaust, and at the end of the day, by that point, we were just throwing in so many numbers. So were the Russians. We had total air superiority. So even if they mounted any significant resistance, we could just pummel them from the air.
Air superiority is really a key factor over Germany and winning World War II.
Exactly. Now, when you look at the Iran-Iraq War, the reason why that devolved into trench warfare was because as time progressed after World War II, you saw the advent of what was known as the RPG-7. And the RPG-7 was a brilliant piece of Russian military technology. It was simple. It was deadly. I mean, to this day, the RPG-7 can destroy the latest and greatest U.S. Army M1A1 Abrams tank and the latest
A mobile or a shoulder-mounted weapon? Or
It's a relatively small rocket-propelled grenade. You put it up on your shoulder. It has a handle in the front, a trigger with a handle in the back. You squeeze the trigger. It goes off. It can be fired by a child with great effectiveness.
So
this was something that you didn't have. During World War II, there wasn't that great counter to the tank. Yeah, the Germans had anti-tank artillery, and they had the Panzerfaust. But the fact is that the Russians took immense tank casualties. But again, you didn't have like you do today, where you have mass-produced anti-tank weapons. And additionally, again, another thing I want to get into is that during the Iran-Iraq War, both air forces were relatively evenly matched, so no one side gained total air superiority, which meant that when you hit what's a blockhouse. A collection of entrenchments, tanks, and whatnot. No one side had so much air superiority, could just pummel through the tanks and then roll through, which is what you had during World War II. We had total air superiority over the Germans. So when we hit a cluster of German defenses, because they had trenches too, we had a cluster of trenches or German defenses, hammer them from the air, and then our troops would roll in and knock them out on the ground.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context. We're talking about the global war situation, in particular about the soundness of present U.S. military defense strategy with its reliance on technology. And we're beginning the discussion with sort of an overview, looking at World War I and World War II, the history of the evolution of military strategy and technology. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott-Rowe. Can I ask, moving along closer to the present, let me ask you two questions. How would you characterize, what do you think the next war would look like if it was a war between the U.S. and China or the U.S. in Russia, and what is America's current military philosophy?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think what it would look like is a repeat of the Six-Day War in many, many ways, because we don't have the military capacity to either produce or to train. We don't have the capacity to have as much equipment or as many soldiers or mass produce what is destroyed the way the Russians and the Chinese do. I think what you might see be a little bit more analogous to the Six-Day War, if anything, which was the Arab-Israeli War of 1967, where the Israelis knocked out the entire Arab Air Force within 24 hours and just rolled over the Arab armies because they had total air superiority. The key for us in the next major war would be to maintain air superiority. The problem is in terms of stealth technology, in terms of long-range hypersonic ballistic missiles, in terms of submarine technology, the Russians have got, and the Chinese both, have an immense leg up on us. If they can knock out our air force within the first 24 hours of any major war, whether it's our European Command Air Force, whether it's our Pacific Command, or whether it's our U.S. Command Air Force, if they can knock out our aircraft within the first 24 hours and can obtain total air superiority, they will prevent it from devolving into trench warfare.
Marshawn, let me give out our phone number people join the conversation. If you have a question for Marshawn or you want a comment you would like to make, we'd be happy to hear it. Like, you can call 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756 to join the conversation on WPKN's In Context. We're talking about America's current military strategy, its reliance on technology, and whether it's really adequate for today's military realities. How would our adversaries, the Russians and the Chinese, knock out our air power?
Well, and this is the scary part. Again, folks, I'm going to give out these names. I'm going to say them slowly because I want you to go look this up. My philosophy is I want you to challenge me. If you think I'm wrong, go look this up. I mean, it's scary, but the Russians just commissioned two new Borei-class submarines, B-O-R-E-I, Borei-class submarines, The Alexander Nevsky is the one that's currently in trials, and then there was another one that was the Yuri, and I can't pronounce the last name, but it's that one's actually already at sea. These are submarines that use underwater jet propulsion. They run silent. This is right out of Tom Clancy's Hunt for Red October. They run silent. They're also equipped with the latest and greatest Bulava ballistic missiles. Now, these are known as quasi-ballistic missiles because they fly very low. They can be launched from a vertical position, which means they can be launched from a moving submarine. Underwater, they will travel low, so they will travel under radar. They can also travel relatively high up and launch 10 independent warheads, each individually guided, to target 10 different facilities or installations. And that's just from one ballistic missile.
Say this again. So one missile can release 10 guided warheads.
Exactly. And they had some problems when they
from a submarine.
From a submarine. Moving.
Which is moving. And obviously underwater.
Exactly. Now, this is a great force multiplier because one of the problems is that our current naval thinking is that we have more aircraft carriers than anyone in the world. And our aircraft carriers can carpet any country in bombs. Well, what the Bulava missile does and the Borei submarine does is it allows the Russians, and by extension the Chinese, because don't mistake the fact that the Chinese have the same technology the Russians do. They share. Which is why both of them have developed stealth fighter bombers that look identical. That's a different story. These submarines, all you would need is one on each side of the U.S., one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, and you could hit every major American city. Because if one missile has 10 independent warheads, it launches up. Well, first of all, if it's off the U.S. coast, we have about 30 seconds of warning before they hit any major American city. If the missile launches up, you could have one missile target 10 major American cities. If you launch, each one carries about 12 of these Bulava missiles. 12 times 10 is 120 warheads. So that means you could hit from one submarine 120 independent targets.
From a whole different, and I would say even scarier point of view. Shall I give out the phone number again, shall we have any callers on the line yet?
Yeah, I was about to do that myself.
Okay, Doug, our phone number is 203-336-9756, and we're talking about military strategy here of the U.S.
Marshawn, can you spell, please, the Bulava?
Oh, absolutely. The Bulava is B-U-L-A-V-A. Bulava. Yes. That's one thing that I like when they Romanize these things from Russian. They usually get it ballpark.
Yeah, they have some license to change. But yeah. You're talking about now attack on the continental United States as opposed to just targeting air bases that we might have in Turkey or wherever.
If you were getting to the ballpark of targeting air bases in places like Turkey, well, first of all, I mean, if you had one of these submarines in the Persian Gulf, again, you could hit 120 targets at once. You could flatten our entire air defense system in the entire Middle East. Additionally, though, and again, there's another scary factor. The Chinese and the Russians have developed new fifth-generation fighter bombers.
Yeah.
Now, what makes these unique is these fighter bombers are capable of air-to-air combat. They're also capable of hitting ground targets. They're also stealth. And that's scary because the stealth fighter bomber means they can fly, they can gain air superiority because we won't see their air force coming. So if you launched a coordinated attack with Iskanders, which are hypersonic, which because they're hypersonic, we won't have time to stop them or be able to stop them, submarines and these fifth generation fighter bombers, you can hammer our ground forces and our air forces before they take off. And because we wouldn't have any warning time, and because we are in cognitive dissonance about the threat of the Russians and the Chinese, a first strike by them could devastate our military capabilities. And one thing I'd also like to point out is the Bulava missile is capable of not only countermeasure being guided, but it's capable of using countermeasures. It's also capable of doing its own evasive maneuvers. It's also hardened, get this, against EMP attack. It's hardened against electronic interference from without, and it's also hardened against nuclear blast. The Bulava missile can withstand a nuclear blast up to 500 meters away.
Well, now you talked earlier about the drones, and it's interesting to note, you know, we have these drone warfare that we're conducting in Yemen and other countries. It's become a very important part of U.S. military strategy. John Brennan, who has just been nominated to head the Central Intelligence Agency and is presently Obama's top counterterrorism expert, is a huge advocate of drone warfare. Are we going down the wrong route by relying on these drones?
Absolutely. I mean, our concept of relying on drones is as anachronistic as thinking that building a battleship with a, you know, 15-mile range cannon is a good idea. The problem with the drone is the drone is great if you want to bomb a bunch of insurgents in Afghanistan. It's great if you know, for domestic security, watching the border. But to use as a mainstay weapon of war, it's absurd. In Somalia, and again, you know, folks, you can look this up, our drones have crashed, quote unquote, in places like Somalia, Afghanistan. They can be brought down by small arms fire. And now, if you're talking about a conventional army with things like radar and anti-aircraft guns, it would be a no-brainer. And they have drones of their own. The Russians and the Chinese have drones of their own, and they have stealth drones. Because guess what, folks? They captured a CIA RQ-176 drone. It was a CIA stealth drone. It was brought down in Iran, completely undamaged, by electronic warfare experts. My guess, they were Russian and Chinese electronic warfare experts.
Yeah, people may have seen this on the news because it did make the American press. It's quite a deal, although I think we claimed it had landed due to technical difficulties.
Exactly, but of course we're going to claim that. Right. You know, we're not going to admit that they have better technology than we do. But the biggest problem we have here is that what we're looking at is now they captured it, and it was in Russia Today, it was in RIA Novosti, it was in the People's Daily in China, it was in Press TV. The first people to come and visit the drone and get the schematics for it were the Russian and Chinese scientists. No bloody wonder they wanted the technology too, and they already had it to a great extent. Now they have it even better. So now they have their own stealth drones. The other thing is they now have stealth submarines. The Russians developed a stealth cruiser, which now it's a regular surface ship that doesn't appear on radar.
So again, this is the key. If you don't make noise, you don't appear on radar.
On sonar.
On sonar. Then you obviously can't be attacked. Or
exactly.
You're going to be able to sneak up.
And if you're a surface ship and you can't appear on radar, it's going to be a pain in the neck to target you because they can't see you.
Right.
I mean, they can see you, but they can't see you on radar. So you can't lock onto the ship. In order to lock onto the ship, you have to be able to pick them up on radar or some kind of guidance system. And this is part of the brilliance of it. Is that if the Russians can see you on radar, but you can't see them, they can hit you from a distance when you're out of line of sight. Okay. And if you're out of line of sight, then...
Let me ask a question a little bit differently. Let's say you are the President of the United States. You are going to continue this policy of military expansion, which is leading us to confrontations with China in the Pacific and Russia in the Mideast and elsewhere. How would you change what we do with military technology, assuming you're going to continue to go down that route?
Well, what you'd have to do is first of all, one thing we need to do is we need to get out of this la-la land where we say the Russians and the Chinese, they wouldn't go to war with us, they need us. BS. Absolute BS. The Russians and the Chinese, the Cold War is back in spades, right? Your enemy doesn't stay... We did not wage total war against the Russians or the Chinese. Of course, they're going to come back and they're going to want their empire back. What we would have to do is we have to ramp up. If we're determined to go down this path, if we wanted to avoid war with the Russians and the Chinese, we'd pull back and we'd be like Switzerland. We'd build up our defenses. We'd have national conscription. Everybody would have a gun. We'd have the best national defense on the planet. If we're determined to militarily expand and to confront the Russians and the Chinese for the superpower status, we're going to need... We'll need conscription. We need more manpower. Case in point being that in every war in human history, it has always, regardless of technology, come down to boots on the ground. You know, World War II, the Germans had the best military technology on the planet. We had more people than they did. Our tanks were third, fourth rate to the German tanks. We could, for every one of ours they destroyed, we could produce 10. For every one of theirs they destroyed, they might produce one. For every one of theirs we destroyed, I mean, they might produce one. So we also need to ramp up our armaments industry. We need to, and I'm not advocating war. I'm just giving you that. I'm a technical expert. No politics. I'm a technical expert, and this is
the premise that I gave you is that we are going to continue the current foreign policy of military expansion.
And that's what I'm saying is, you know, I'm not telling you this because I'm biased in any way. I'm telling you this because these are the hard and cold military facts. We have to ramp up our armaments industry. We have to be able to invest in a in home defenses. We need air raid shelters. We need early warning systems. We need military units and bases that are based close to the major urban areas. We can't have Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri as a major military installation when we have no major military facilities near Chicago or near L.A. You know, we need to start repositioning our military domestically to defend our coastline, to defend our borders. We have to tighten up our security on the border of Mexico, because not only can Mexican drug cartels get through, but enemy special forces and agents could get through. Enemy troops could get through if they were to invade up through Mexico. We have to tighten our borders. We have to resituate our armed forces.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, streaming live at WPKN.org. Name of show, In Context. We're on every Monday, except the first Monday of the month, from noon to 1. And today we're talking about U.S. military strategy. Is it obsolete? If you'd like to make a comment or ask Marchand a question, our call-in number is 203-336-9756. We're just going to be on for about another 10 minutes, so give us a ring now if you'd like to join the conversation. We'd like to hear from you what your thoughts are. In particular, as the question I posed Marchand was an assumption we continue the current military, the current foreign policy of military expansion, all whether it's in Africa or the Middle East or Asia. That's a premise which was not, you know, that was just a premise for the question. If you have a different view, maybe you think we should have a different foreign policy, that'd be, you know, we'd be interested in hearing what your ideas and what a new American foreign policy would look like.
And part of what I'm trying to say is also this is the cost of expansionism too, because this is going to cost millions. But you know what, folks? You can't wage a war on peanuts, and you can't wage it on technology alone. If this does bring to a confrontation with Russia or China, or just the risk of one, we can't sit in the dark and just say, well, it's not going to happen, there's going to be no confrontation, and then continue our military expansionism. If we're going to continue with this expansionism, we have to be prepared for a major war.
Well, as we saw earlier, as we were discussing the situation in Syria, it looks like the Russians did up the ante in Syria. They brought in these very powerful hypersonic Iskander missiles, and we in response moved our fleet off the coast of Syria. And I have to get to Obama's credit; he didn't want a confrontation, but the Russian fleet is now sitting where our fleet used to sit. And I think it's it's naive of us to think the Russians, the Chinese are not going to counter our expansion if we keep moving the way we're moving.
Well, and I think that's the very dangerous reality of what's happening, is that we've set a precedence as far as the Russians are concerned, that we've set a very dangerous precedence now as far as the Russians are concerned, that
they know they can push us down.
That they know they can push us down, yeah. That they know they can push us around, but also that they know that the Russians and the Chinese also know that it is go time. This is the make or break it moment.
Yeah, we're getting
pushing
closer
them
and closer.
Now they have to push back.
And that's one
because
why
if they don't push back, if they back down, that's it. They'll have given up the world.
And that's why we do this show, Marchand and I come on, because we want you to know what's really going on. We don't want you to go with the stuff, you know, that you might get from the corporate media. You want to know what's really happening out there. Do we have a caller, Shell?
We have a caller.
Oh, wonderful. You just put him through and hello, caller, you're on the air? We're just twisting our buttons and pushing their knobs here. You want to check out Marchand? So again, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM. We're on every Monday except the first Monday of the month. And we're giving a lot of emphasis to the global wars because we are getting closer and closer to confrontation, a very dangerous confrontation around the world with Russia and China. And it's really not being adequately reported in the mainstream media. We're just not getting the real picture there. You get bits and pieces of it, but they've kind of lulled the American people into a false sense of security. And one of the things we've covered in the show, too, of course, it's the politics. Do we have a hello, listener? Are you on the air?
Do I hear you?
Oh, great. You're on the air now. Could you give us your first name, please, and where you're calling from?
And Jeff calls from planet Earth.
Hi, Jeff. Okay. Do you have a question or a comment on our discussion here?
Well, man, I understand your point of the discussion. What I fail to understand is how we can spend more trillions of dollars we don't have fighting a war that will end everything. Is it just that we're in a rush to make ourselves extinct, that we won't wait for the climate to boil us off the planet? We might as well just end it all.
Jeff, I think it's an excellent question. You know, I when I ask Marchand, it really approaches from a technical point of view. But from what you're saying, I think you're suggesting we need to do foreign policy. And I think that's what kind of foreign policy would you like us to have?
Well, I think that the idea that we're going to fight and fight and fight over, or prepare to fight over, what is it we hope to accomplish?
Well,
it's not like we hope that Russians aren't going to come here and steal all our
I think this is really cool. It gets to the heart of it, Jeff. And thanks so much for your question, because it seems to me that, Marshawn, that the focus of American military policy, foreign policy, is to gain control globally of the world's natural resources, particularly oil and natural gas, and not to defend the continent, the territory of the United States. So as a result, we have 700 bases around the world. We're fighting wars all over the world, and we really don't do anything about defending the United States itself.
And I think, because again, a lot of it is after the Cold War, we established this mentality that we are dominant, we are the world superpower, no one can touch us, and our entire premise of world intervention has been based on that theory since 1991. We won the Cold War. We're untouchable. Well, now the fact is that history continues. History doesn't stop. There's never an end point in history. We viewed 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union as the end of history, but it wasn't. History continues. And the fact is that what we're seeing now is a resurgence in Russia and China and the Cold War being reborn. The problem we face is that we are like the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War I. We still think we're the unquestioned ruler of our hemisphere, and indeed the unquestioned superpower. But the fact is, we're not. And if we don't wake up and realize that soon, we're going to find ourselves like Austro-Hungary did, no longer in existence.
Jeff, thank you so much for your call. I think you've really provoked us to talk, to move this conversation in another direction, which is, you know, to re-examine what the objective of our foreign policy is. Is it to control the route of natural gas from the former Soviet republics through Afghanistan? I mean, that's why we're over there. I mean, is that what the American people want? Do they want us to control the Persian Gulf oil? Are they willing to spill American blood over this in greater quantities? Or if not, you know, what kind of policy do they want?
I think we have another caller.
Well, you can continue your thoughts about warmongering, but the planet will melt and render all of it irrelevant.
Well, that's a whole other issue. So can we move on? Excuse me. Thanks very much. This is Jeff still?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, Jeff, if you could hang on, if you could just hang up, we have another caller on the line.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Jeff.
We have another
call. You want to check that?
I think our caller hung up.
Okay, Doug. Maybe we can try the caller.
I'm
could
here.
Try to call.
Oh, you're here.
Oh, great.
Okay, good. Hello,
okay,
John.
I was trying to get through earlier.
What's your name again, please?
John.
Oh, John. Thanks for calling, John.
Island.
Okay, we just have a couple minutes left, so
it brief and succinct.
Right.
I've spent 32 years in the Merchant Marines carrying various cargoes overseas.
Right.
And seeing how at first they were strictly commercial, and now military in nature, I believe that all this talk about war and all that is foo-foo. The important thing is, who has these contracts? Who's making the money? Oil and gas will always be the same demand. Now, the price may vary and fluctuate, but always people will be using the same amounts, more or less, you know, seasonal variations. But there's no demand at all for an $18 billion Homeland Security budget, which is $4 billion more than a combined FBI and DEA. There's why a need to have 8 carrier groups or 12 carrier groups. All of these things, all the satellite contracts, where the real money is, if we had legislation, and I doubt we will, that we required Congress to declare where they made their money from in all regards, maybe we might see a little cinching of the economic belt. But
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, John, but with almost $1 trillion in defense spending, you got a pretty good point.
And to be honest, I mean, if we did what Switzerland did and we became very focused on national defense, if we decided, you know what, we're going to give up our 700 military bases.
Who's going to invade us?
Well, that's
the end of the case right there. I'm sorry, fellows.
Okay, I'm afraid we'll have to...
Nobody's going to invade them.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, John, because Rick Petrone is on deck and ready to come in with the jazz sounds. And we hope you'll stay tuned. And stay tuned to WPKN all day. This has been In Context, 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, WPKN.org, streaming live. It will be on next Monday from noon to 1. And stay tuned for Rick Petrone. And thank you, Shell, for handling the board.
Thank you very much.